going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
It is the Going Deep Podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett, and I do love the NFL draft. I mean, I love all things football, NFL included, but evidently I'm not alone. The NFL draft is so widely consumed, so anticipated, and now it's gone. I miss it already. When I was in university, me and my housemates would watch every rep of the combine, every single pick of the draft. I don't have that sort of time anymore at this stage and age of my life, but I love the draft none the same because everyone is hopeful. Everyone comes out and says, oh, I won the draft, and oh, we got our pick exactly where we wanted. And yeah, it doesn't matter where we drafted, that player was number one on our board. The propaganda starts early. Maybe some of it is true, but we'll find out that not all of these players will pan out. Who made out well and who maybe should have done a little bit more studying before the exam that is the NFL draft? Well, who better to ask than Russell Brown, NFL draft analyst for Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros, also writes for the Lions Wire. You hear him on the Detroit Lions podcast. So many of our Windsor faithful who are Lions fans know his work well. Well, you all should know it. You're going to get to know it real soon as we go deep on all things NFL draft with Russell Brown. Russell, I love, love, love the NFL draft. It mirrors a little bit stock market, but also a reality show with, you know, some gamesmanship, yeah, some alliances. So there's some poker involved, and obviously there's the fantasy aspect and the football scouts aspect of identifying great players and team building. Although I'm fully aware that our jump to ascribe winners and losers now, before anyone has put on a helmet or pads, is somewhat foolish. But here we are, and we're going to do it anyways. Maybe not in terms of, you know, who had the most impact were the players on their team. Who do you feel leveraged their positioning and the opportunity the most in the draft?
Well, that's a great question, because I think you hit the nail on the head. I think some of these draft grades and things like that are a little bit premature, because just because, you know, let's say we have a second round grade on a wide receiver and he ends up going a little bit later and didn't end up going in the beginning of the second round, does not make it a bad pick. Sometimes just players go to certain spots because of where they fit schematically. And sometimes there's more to it than meets the eye, like, you know, the interview process, and maybe they don't know if that guy's going to fit the locker room as well and those types of things. But just off of surface level stuff and looking at kind of how the draft went for certain teams, and obviously all 32 teams, but looking at just the first team that always pops out to me is Arizona. They got the best player in the draft in Marvin Harrison Jr. Out of Ohio State. He's going to be a guy that I think is there for the majority of his career, and he's going to just be a great asset to that offense, a guy that they can build that offense around. It seems like they've kind of ironed things out with Kyler Murray. We'll see what happens, but regardless, whoever the quarterback is of the future, they've got a great number one weapon there. Darius Robinson in the first round and Max Melton in the second round are great additions to that defense. They desperately need help on defense. Max Melton was a player that I got to talk to during the pre-draft process down at the Senior Bowl. And I liked the way he carried himself. He was very confident. I liked the way he plays. The same thing with Darius Robinson. Got to talk with him and his family. He's from my neck of the woods here in Metro Detroit. So it was just great getting to catch up with him. And then, you know, they got Trey Benson in the third round. Some people thought he was going to be the first running back off the board. But at the end of the day, like, he a little bit reminds me of TJ Yeldon, but they needed help there in that running back room. So I just like what they did collectively. They had a ton of draft capital and they capitalized on multiple players, got a bunch of depth and created competition that they desperately need. Another team that, you know, it's hard to look past what they did. Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, they had a great draft just from the talent that they got and where they got them. I mean, Cooper DeJean in the second round, I think, is great value, you know, 41st overall pick. He was my 35th ranked player, but there was some first round buzz there. Quinyon Mitchell, first corner off the board. They got him at 22. There was a thought that Quinyon and Terrion Arnold would go somewhere in the teens. They got him and Cooper DeJean to really help that secondary out, which they desperately need. And with Vic Fangio, he gets two guys that he can utilize perfectly. Jalen Tone's going to be a nice rotational player off the edge. And then just offensively, you know, they added some guard help with Trevor Keegan, Dylan McMahon. I like the pass catchers in Johnny Wilson and Anais Smith. Anais Smith, maybe the more underrated pass catcher in this draft, very versatile, can play anywhere. And Will Shipley, with Saquon Barkley kind of in and out of lineups over the last 2 years, Will Shipley's a player to kind of keep eyes on because he can catch passes out of the backfield, and really his one-cut style of running will really be beneficial for the Eagles. So those are just two teams that immediately stand out. Obviously, I could go, you know, team by team, but, you know, for the sake of time, I'll start with those two.
Well, what stood out to me in what you said was that Marvin Harrison Jr. is the best player in the draft. Some people didn't necessarily have him as the best receiver in this draft. And obviously, if you're saying he's the best player in the draft, you're saying that you project him to be even more impactful than Caleb Williams, who went one overall. Talk to me about why you're so bullish on Marvin Harrison Jr.
Well, I just look at the way he plays, and to see him move the way he does at 6'4", 205 pounds, and I know he didn't do any testing and those types of things, but just looking at what he's able to do, he's so talented and he's so fluid, and it's rare for a player of that size and that caliber to be that efficient and that fluid in all three levels of the field. Sometimes you might only have a guy that can run vertical routes or guys that can catch passes behind the line of scrimmage on design screens. But when you look at Marvin Harrison Jr., he can do it anywhere on the field, and he can do it better than just about anybody. And just when you look at wide receivers that we've seen over the years, it was really hard to find negatives and weaknesses within his game. It really was. And I feel like if you were, you were probably being a little bit nitpicking or just being a little bit different from, I guess, I don't want to say groupthink, but just different from what maybe what is supposed to be thought. Because I get why people like Malik Nabers and I get why people like Roma Dunze, but just looking at Marvin Harrison, he's just so different. And then, you know, with Caleb Williams, he was a close number one overall player for me, but just the fact that it's the quarterback position and it's so hard to project what those guys are going to do, I just felt safer projecting Marvin Harrison Jr. to the next level.
All right. We have spent 10 minutes and we haven't talked about the Atlanta Falcons yet, which I think is an accomplishment. And it has been a week, and I try to, in general, understand that people are experts for a reason, that they have more information and more at stake than I do. And so generally, they probably have a thought process and a plan. Having said that, I still can't, for the life of me, make sense of the process or plan for what the Falcons did at the top of the draft, picking yet another quarterback after they spent a good portion of their cap on a quarterback. I think Cousins and Penix individually are good choices. I don't know if they make sense together. Is there a rationale that makes sense for you in the team building approach that Atlanta has taken?
I mean, I'm with you. I've tried to be very optimistic with it, trying to be very positive, because I feel bad tearing down Michael Penix, because it's nothing against him as a player. He just didn't have first-round caliber tape consistently across, you know, the last 4 or 5 years. There were splashes, certainly, this past year where you could justify saying, hey, this guy's playing great. But, you know, changing to the NFL and adapting to that, you know, he doesn't throw with a lot of touch. He's all fastball, no changeup, no curveball, no nothing. He's just all velocity with his throws. And a lot of his throws are outside the numbers, which are common in the NFL at times. I mean, just speaking from experience of watching the Lions my entire life, seeing Matthew Stafford when he was really turnover worthy and turnover worthy throws and turnover prone, the Jim Caldwell and the organization at the time made it transition to only have throws outside the numbers, and that helps limit turnovers. So I understand why that might make sense. And, you know, just putting it on the other side here, being optimistic, Kirk Cousins, Michael Penix, it was clear that they wanted to get their quarterback room better. And when you look at what they did last year at quarterback, Desmond Ridder, Tyler Heineke, those were guys that they didn't want those guys just being the only quarterbacks that they had. So they made it a point that they were going to bring in Kirk Cousins, bring in the veteran. You have Michael Penix, and the hope is Penix can learn from Cousins. Cousins can be the leader and be on the field for most of this year, maybe next year, and eventually you turn it over to Michael Penix. And if Cousins is not fully healthy and is not fully on board, you still have your backup plan in Michael Penix. So I think that was really the only mindset that they had. I certainly think that they had other areas of need that they could be drafting players like Leiatu Latu or Dallas Turner or even Tyrion Arnold, but they wanted to go with the quarterback and they wanted to make sure that they took care of the most important position on the field. So I completely understand it.
Yeah, I just wonder if maybe they should try to make their defensive line room better.
But interestingly,
sort of mindset at the quarterback position this year was not unique to them. The Denver Broncos front office is probably thanking them for taking Penix at eight, because otherwise we probably would have led this talking about the fact that they took Nix at 12. We saw so many QBs go so early. Is that a referendum on the importance of the position, on the lack of interest in the position in 2025? What did you make on the run of quarterbacks so early?
I think it really was just about the need for the position. And when you know, and when we started this whole draft process, I mean, we kind of get lost in the process, right? Myself included. And we look at best player available and those types of things. But when you look at the entire first round as a whole and the teams that were picking in the top 15, there was no denying that Chicago, Washington, New England, you could make a case for the Giants, you have Atlanta, you had Minnesota, and you had Denver, and you even had a team like the Las Vegas Raiders where you could justify saying these teams could take a quarterback. And we all felt that kind of in the beginning of this process and up until about the Senior Bowl when Michael Penix and Bo Nix went out there and didn't have necessarily great weeks. They didn't light it up like Josh Allen and Baker Mayfield did years before them. And that was kind of the expectation. Being that they had that rough week, it kind of felt like, okay, J.J. McCarthy has put himself in front of those guys. Those guys are more like second rounders, late ones, day two guys. And that was just kind of the assumption across the media and across some of the people in the league. But it was clear that those teams that we talked about, you know, the six or seven teams in the top 15 of the draft that needed quarterback help, they clearly wanted to just take advantage of the quarterbacks that were at the top of the draft, get them on their roster and create that competition now and really see what 2025 brings. Because there's always the uncertainty. There's the known versus the unknown. And the unknown is what is Carson Beck going to do? What is Shadeer Sanders going to do next year? We don't necessarily know. We do know what we're getting out of J.J. McCarthy as far as a college prospect, Michael Penix, Bo Nix, and those things. So I think that's what teams really took it as, and they'll reassess the quarterback room after this season.
The other move that I made, or no real understanding of, or series of moves, and I'm two ways, so hopefully you can help me get to a place where it makes more sense to me, is the Buffalo Bills, who needed a wide receiver, certainly had the ability to take one in the first round, traded down twice, but for me, most importantly, traded with the Kansas City Chiefs, who went up to get Xavier Worthy, the same franchise who traded with the Chiefs, who went up to get Patrick Mahomes. The same franchise, the Chiefs, who they have not been able to beat in the postseason three of the last 4 years. I would be the one saying, listen, you can't cut off your nose to spite your face. You have to do what's best for your ball club. But this is a relative competition. You're trying to get good relative to your opponents. It didn't sit well with me, even though the other side of my brain understands that if Coleman is a better fit for you in your offense and you have them in vertical spaces on your board and you think you can get him later, then it's not a big deal that the Panthers get Legatin, that the Chiefs, more importantly, get Worthy if you still get your guy in the second round. Do you have a problem with that move by Buffalo with that team?
I do, personally. I mean, I don't have a problem with them taking Keon Coleman. Stylistically, he fits. They needed kind of a prototypical X receiver. Coleman can certainly do that. I think he's going to be a great pair with Dalton Kincaid and Curtis Samuel, Khalil Shakir, and Josh Allen. But you just, you mentioned it. They gave up the pick to get Pat Mahomes to the Chiefs, and now they do this with Xavier Worthy, who is, you know, a very good fit in that offense for how they spread the football around and how they like to take those deep shots. And, you know, there was nobody faster in the draft. And when we look at some of the vertical threat receivers, there's not many better than Xavier Worthy. It might've been Brian Thomas Jr. and then Xavier Worthy, maybe Malik Nabers. But, you know, when we look at the explosive plays and the adjustments and the acrobatic catches, Xavier Worthy did all of those things. And now he gets to do it with the best quarterback on the planet. So, like, when we're seeing them play each other in the AFC Championship game and Xavier Worthy's outplaying Keon Coleman and the Chiefs are outplaying the Bills, it's because of things like this. So it's a bit of a head-scratching move. I think maybe the Bills just wanted to move down to get some extra draft capital because they had a lot of positions of need. You know, they revamped their roster. They moved on from guys like Stephon Diggs, Mitch Morse, and, you know, Jordan Poyer and some of those veteran guys. So they wanted to get some depth and bring in some talent, which I understand and get, but at the same time, I just don't know, like, were they just trying to justify taking Keon Coleman because of the run of the receivers, or they just wanted to get the capital? Like, it just, they didn't want to trade with the Patriots, which I thought was weird. You know, the Patriots are so far away from you that, you know, I understand you might be throwing them a bone to let them come back up and get a pass catcher or an offensive tackle, but you're helping a team that is winning now and is going to continue to compete for Super Bowls much more frequently than probably the New England Patriots. So I just, it was a head-scratching move, and I don't understand it.
Well, the interesting thing in terms of evaluating receivers is recently there have been so many rookie receivers that have hit right away, that have given you all-pro level production on rookie contracts. Essentially, just pick someone coming out of Ohio State and LSU, and you got yourself a Pro Bowler. But at the same time, there have been so many receivers who have been found late. Puka Nacua, Cooper Kupp, Tyreek Hill, that have been among the best in the league. It's not just about picking great players. The draft is about finding value, positional value. When you look at the way teams are finding and maybe more importantly developing receivers, which trend do you think is the most efficient?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, for these wide receivers is getting them into a place where not only do they fit schematically, but get them to a place where you're getting relatively high level quarterback play and there's opportunities for them right away. Because we often think, like, with quarterbacks, right? Like, it's important for them to sit for a year and gain that, you know, mentorship and all that stuff that they need. Where I think with wide receivers, the only way that they can really develop their skills is by being out there running routes and learning the timing and getting that timing down with quarterbacks. And I think the biggest thing is teams, you know, with some of these teams in the NFL, they're looking at obviously where can they select these players, right? Like, I'm not going to, you know, if I feel like this guy's a second round wide receiver, I'm not going to necessarily take him in the top 15 of the draft. But if you move down, you acquire some extra picks, kind of like the Bills did with Keon Coleman, now you can justify taking that guy at 33, even if he wasn't your 33rd overall player or your 25th overall player. But I think the biggest thing is just getting these players on the field as quickly as possible, because it is a win now league. And I think we often forget that some teams and some organizations just don't have that window to sit and develop a wide receiver right away. So sometimes you got to force your hand and take the guy that best fits you early in the draft. And that's why we're seeing some of these guys hit much sooner, because they're getting the opportunity to play. But sometimes it does pay off holding off, but it's every year it's a little bit different. And this year there was a run on wide receivers. We'll see how it works out. But if you go back to, 2021, there was a lot of day two and day three guys that myself and other people that, are evaluators and things like that, that were very high on these pass catchers. And some of them, they just didn't pan out. But I think the big thing is just getting those guys on the field as quickly as you can.
As you're looking at the entire draft and team's entire board, I wonder what your opinion is on the depth that we're seeing in the draft. More players staying in school because of NIL, a bit cloudy in terms of how to evaluate some players because you've got the COVID year, and so age ranges are all over the place. And we have seen some teams, you mentioned the Eagles and Howie Roseman, saying those day three picks, we may not need them as much. Let's get up early and get more premium players in the first three rounds of the draft, because those day three picks, if we really like them, we might be able to pick them off of people's practice rosters later in the year. When you look at the depth of the entire draft, are there any trends that you are starting to see?
Well, I think one of the big things is we're seeing, I feel like the talent at offensive line is getting deeper and deeper year by year. I just feel like, sure, you can find value with guards and centers, but over the last 4 or 5 years, I feel like we're seeing more and more conversation of having a guard and a center in the first round more often than not, where I feel like maybe that didn't happen as much in years prior. And a lot of that is because of some of the athletic testing that comes with the combine and pro days now, and tracking players' speed when they get out in space or down the field. And when you see a way that a player that's 6'4", 325 pounds, 6'5", 330 pounds, to see how fast they move on the field live in time, I think you can justify taking those players much sooner than before. And then, you take it a step further. It's about, if you're an offense, it's about scoring points. So the only way you're going to score points is by having a good offensive line. And I think a team like the Detroit Lions is showcasing that. A team like the Philadelphia Eagles is showing that. And I think teams want to get behind that. So I'm noticing just more and more offensive line. I mean, we had a historic run on offensive linemen in this first round and really in this draft. And I think next year's draft is going to be loaded as well. So I would say that, we're still seeing that. And offensive tackle is still a premium position. You want left and right tackles. Obviously, quarterbacks, there's always going to be that push for premium position there. And the same thing for wide receivers. I mean, it truly is becoming a pass-happy league, as we've seen. But we're seeing more and more wide receivers year in and year out. We're talking, 15 to 20 wide receivers on a yearly basis, sometimes 25 to 26, which, you go back to 1995, there wasn't 25 wide receivers getting drafted. There might have been 25 running backs getting drafted, but there wasn't wide receivers. So the league's changing a little bit. We're starting to see guys that played, wide receiver, maybe move into the running back role a little bit, just so they get the football a little bit more frequently. And the same for running backs moving to wide receiver. They're not getting paid as much at running back. They want to get paid. They move to kind of that slot receiver role. So those are kind of the trends that we're seeing, just more players playing wide receiver, some that convert to running back a little bit in that pass catcher role. But the run on offensive line is just incredible.
Well, one offensive lineman that surprised some people, that excited many Canadians, is Giovanni Manu, yeah. The 6'8", 350-pound tackle out of the University of British Columbia. Brad Holmes and the Detroit Lions seem to just be on a heater and saying, no matter what convention is, we'll take a inline linebacker in the first round. We'll take a running back early. We don't care. We'll take a tackle from the Can West Conference in Canada. We'll do it while we're wearing Dan Campbell's jersey. You mentioned the search for people that big and that athletic. Did that pick surprise you? Is that someone that you had on your board?
No, I mean, fortunately, I was able to watch his tape after they selected him and covering the Lions for the Lions Wire with USA Today. I'm very fortunate to be able to watch a little bit of him. But yeah, it's evident to why teams were very intrigued with him. Teams are looking for that next Jordan Mulata out of like the Philadelphia Eagles. And when you see a guy that, whether he's playing in Canada or he's playing in Australia or England or wherever, you whether it's international or not, if you can play, they'll come find you. And that's the thing. I mean, 6'7", 352 pounds, ran a 4.96, 33.5-inch vertical, put up 23 reps in the bench. Just impressive pro day. He carries his weight very well. And when you watch the tape, you see a guy that you can tell is a former basketball player, the lateral movement skills. The way he moves, he looks like a power forward or a center going down in the post and down low. And I think a team like the Lions, they've been looking for this big offensive tackle. They did it with Vitae. They brought him over from the Eagles. It didn't end up working out because of his back. And I think they're just trying to find a way to replace that. But this is a guard tackle, flexible fit for their offensive line. And with some uncertainty around Taylor Decker and Frank Ragnow and Graham Glasgow and Kevin Zietler really only signed for the next year or two, you don't really have the longevity on your offensive line. So the thought was, is bring this guy in. There's a lot of polishing that needs to be done, but if they polish it and they get this guy with the redefined tools, he can be a starter and probably a high caliber starter in the NFL. But I'm excited about him. And I know, you know, obviously, like you said, you know, everybody in Canada is very excited about him. So when I saw British Columbia flash across the screen, I didn't think I was spending my Saturday afternoon breaking down British Columbia, Dave.
Well, did you think you were going to spend your Saturday breaking down punter tape? As in the recent draft era, there's only been three where a punter wasn't taken. But I'm not sure I had the Chicago Bears taking Iowa's Torrey Taylor in the fourth round. I get it. Special teams are a third of the game. But do you think a punter can impact the game at that level to use such a priority pick on one?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think one of the big reasons to why Torrey Taylor went was, you know, he broke an 85-year-old record from the NCAA. You know, he was punting the ball 67, 70 yards down the field. He had the most punts in the FBS in 2023. And when you think of just the strategy of the game of flipping the field, and you see a guy that handles a heavy workload and is able to, you know, flip the field consistently, that's important. And I think it was one of those things where, you know, with the Chicago Bears, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to fall into that strategy. And it also helps, you know, your rookie quarterback, if he's struggling at any point, which there's going to be struggles for him. I mean, the Packers got better defensively. The Lions got better defensively this offseason. So if he's struggling at any point, now you can play this strategy game and potentially get a 65-yard punt from this young kid. And that will help. It should help ease Caleb Williams as the defense comes back onto the field and those types of things. So I know it's a special, you know, special team player and a punter and a kicker and those types of things. And I'm not always on board to draft them, but some players, there's just certain circumstances. And, you know, you can look at Sebastian Janikowski years ago. It was a second round pick to the Raiders, was a longtime kicker in this league, very successful in a high level, you know, high level player for a position that if you don't get it right, you do struggle. And that's a conversation being had in Detroit right now. People don't know who their kicker is going to be, and they want that kid from the Michigan Panthers. And I don't know if that's going to be the guy that they end up signing, you know, after the UFL season's over. But, you know, teams do go through this, I think, a little bit more than we think. So it's a little, but it's always surprising when we see this position drafted.
And lastly, I know this is a round the clock endeavor. So I want to cascade forward to next year in a prediction that nobody other than the internet will hold you to. If you had to predict who's going to be the first overall pick a year from now, that would be who?
That's a struggle, but I keep leaning towards Carson Beck, the quarterback out of Georgia. I mean, went 13-1 last year. The win-loss stuff matters to decision makers. He's very accurate. He stands tall in the pocket. He can extend plays beyond the pocket, and he makes some throws look effortlessly. So I would have to lean towards him just because of how he operates, and he's just calm, cool, and collected all the time, it feels like.
Well, either way, whenever it happens, we'll bother you to break it down for us. Thank you so much for providing your expertise on the draft, which essentially is just a conference call, but now it is one of the biggest nights in a couple nights in sports, and you do such a great job giving us perspective on it, so thank you.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you so much to Russell, once again, who does such a great job, not just covering the draft, but covering the sport at large. If you want to give him a follow, @RussNFLDraft is his handle on Twitter. keeping you up to date with all of the things that are draft related, and certainly giving you insight specifically about the Lions. As I mentioned, the Detroit Lions podcast and Lions Wire is where you can find his work. This draft was really intriguing for Canadians, and evidently we need to all be Lions fans. I know people who are on the border with Michigan certainly are Lions fans. The Windsor-Chatham area for sure, but you have show Mathieu Betts, the best defensive player for me in the CFL, signing a contract with the Lions this offseason, goes from being a BC Lion to a Detroit Lion. And then you have Manu the Tackle, who goes from University of British Columbia to Detroit. Fascinating times in the NFL, no doubt.
How much were you impressed by Quantez Stiggers? He got drafted as well, I believe, of the Jets, J-E-T Jets.
He did, was rookie of the year in the CFL. Someone who's playing, you know, not even NCAA football before getting to the league. Interesting path to the NFL, but is young enough and has shown that he has competed in a pro environment. Did a great job at the Shrine Bowl, and now he has an opportunity to do a great job in the NFL. Real cool story.
Was he ever one of Enoch's dogs? Did he ever get that far?
He was not Enoch's dog of the week. He let Enoch know about it when he won his hardware at the end of the year. And he will never be Enoch's dog of the week now, as he is in NFL.
That's very true. Well, I have to say, I always did enjoy the woo-woo-woo part of Enoch's talk, so I'm looking forward to that aspect of the CFL season. I got to say, I really enjoy the NFL draft as someone who does not watch a lick of college football. Honestly, like I did not watch a second of any sort of college football at any point this year, and yet, I mean, you know I'm a Pats fan, so as soon as the draft was over, I thought, Drake May is going to be the best quarterback of all time. This is it. You know, screw the Vikings for not trading up, and you know they're gonna have to settle for JJ McCarthy. I mean, sports always, generally speaking, brings out a very, oh, I cheer for the red team, you cheer for the blue team, so screw the blue team, go red team. Like that's a very like primal aspect of sport. But I almost find the NFL draft allows you to get away with that more than almost any other event, because I guarantee you the people who watch the draft are mostly like me in that they are not giant college football experts, but still, you know, attach ludicrous hopes and dreams to players they might have never seen before.
Let me be very clear. The draft is for sickos. Like, if you are that invested in the draft, you need more balance and better priorities in your life. The fact that 700,000 people attended the draft, attended essentially a conference call, a live conference call, is bananas. And to your point, every time they cut to a fan when said team was on the clock, because guess what? There's nothing else to cut to. There is no event. It's a bunch of people in various conference rooms on a conference call and then picking up a cell phone and calling someone directly. But we can't show you that because we can't tell you what the pick is until the pick is in, because this is just a made-for-TV event. So we're going to cut to a random guy with spikes on his shoulder pads and a random helmet, and who has clearly drank too much and face paint, and he's going to wait. He's going to be excited. He's going to pause. He's going to hear a name. It's going to register. He does not know who that is, but he's going to cheer nonetheless, because there is blind faith when it comes to the draft. So, yeah, it is... it is like nothing else in sport. I wonder, because as you know, there's a movement to move the NHL draft from a in-person event for the entire league to a much more virtual event.
Right.
I wonder if it is going to garner the same sort of fanfare and reaction, because now the draft is a traveling sideshow. It was in Vegas a year ago. I was there, as you know. It was in Detroit this year. It is going to Green Bay, Wisconsin next year. So Vegas excluded. Now it has become this thing that cities who have no hope in hell in getting a Super Bowl bid on as a must-see attraction event. Now, Detroit has had a Super Bowl before, but it was essentially you built a new stadium.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You get one. Jerome Bettis, here's your moment in the sun. We're never coming back here because it's freezing cold. Green Bay, regardless if they build a new stadium, is probably never getting a draft. So the fact that it has become literally a mini Super Bowl is wild. I'm not expecting us to see the same in the NHL. I am happy, though, that I no longer will need to see, you know, 17-year-old prospect in Section 103 stand up and then, like, stand on his family's toes as he squirms down the aisle after giving awkward side hugs and then, like, races down the stairs to come on stage and gets a hat and then puts on the jersey that he's swimming in with his suit. I'm glad I won't need to see that aspect of the NHL draft anymore. In many ways, the NFL draft does things right. The green room, you've got the dynamics of the family and the girlfriend, and how long has this girlfriend been a girlfriend? Should right. she be at that table? How long will she stay a girlfriend once the money is cashed into your checking account? Then you've got the aspect of the fashion and the style and the aspect of, oh, you know, we're making this a new era commercial. Like, here's your hat. Put it on in the mirror. Let's see you bend that brim or don't. And then evidently everybody just bro hugs with the commissioner now. Like, Roger Goodell, one of the most hated people in sports other than draft night, where he's everybody's best bro. As you can tell, I can't get enough draft.
Yeah, it's fun. It's funny too, because I was sitting in the Fan 590 studios when the WNBA draft was going on, and I thought to myself, gosh, like, similarly, am I an expert in this? No, but I can't get enough. Like, Aliyah Edwards gets drafted, and I thought, boy, this is exciting. And then the NFL draft, the NBA draft is right around the corner. I feel similarly to you about the NHL draft, because it often seems like the most awkward one. And I do sometimes wonder if that's because, and I've said this a lot, but the NHL has often been the league that I felt has had to have been, like, kind of drag kicking and screaming into the spotlight into the 21st century most of the time. But at the same time, all of these drafts, the worst draft is the MLB draft, because there's like a bazillion rounds in the MLB. There's like 40 rounds in the MLB draft, which they only recently changed. So that's neither here nor there, because it's during the season. It's kind of at an awkward time. You're drafting, you can't draft international players into the MLB draft, but drafts, generally speaking, I think one of the reasons I like watching them so much, and this goes back to the WNBA draft, which just happened, but it I think for me, the reason I like watching it, Donovan, is because it represents so much hope, even if you know nothing about it, right? Like, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on, like, Cameron Brink after watching a handful of Stanford games this season, but at the same time, it is, I find it so much fun to participate in, which is why I can't wait to see what happens with, you know, you look to the NBA draft, and we're going to get the draft lottery probably pretty soon, I got to think. And that's going to have some implication for the Raptors as to whether they keep their top six pick that otherwise would be conveyed to the Spurs as a part of that Pirtle trade. You can be an expert in so many things when you talk about sports, but it never so much as when it comes to drafts of all calibers and all leagues, pretty much.
Well, this year, the NHL draft is in Las Vegas at the Sphere, which is going to increase the production value.
I just want to see if 10, prospects 15%. Get sick when they look around and they're seeing this, the U2 dome there. That's what I want to see.
I have been to the Sphere, and people did get sick. It is quite the experience. Before we go, I want to get your POV on your New England Patriots and what they did via the draft, but specifically at the quarterback position. It's been a position of flux. They got rid of Mac Jones for 10 cents on the dollar. They brought back Jacoby Brissett, who can be a QB babysitter, if you will, for a year or two. Draft Drake May, who at the beginning of this college season, people thought could challenge Caleb Williams for number one overall. By the end of the draft process, people felt like he shouldn't be, never mind the second pick in the draft or QB taken, that maybe there's an argument he shouldn't be in the top three or four. They still have Bailey Zappe, but then later in the draft, they draft Joe Milton III, which only matters because Canadians are mad, trying to figure out what that means for our beloved Nathan Rourke, who, if you go to most NFL websites, does not even register on the depth chart for the New England
Patriots. It's pretty wild, honestly.
I mean, they gave him some guaranteed money and I suppose some assurances, so it is somewhat wild. There has been a notion that teams are going to start to transfer into a 3QB dressing scenario as the NFL season gets longer, and there's real talk that they're going to add an additional game after not so long ago adding a game. Either way, your feeling about the New England Patriots QB and drafting the most Patriots-y-looking quarterback in Drake May is what?
Okay, so let me ask you this. Is the fact that he is Patriots-y-looking, is that just because he's white? Is that why? I kind of agree with you, but I don't know what the other half of that conversation is. I always tread carefully.
In fairness, I think J.J. McCarthy is even more Patriots-y looking.
Fair.
I think Drake May is a little too athletic, you know, Cam Newton notwithstanding, to be a Patriots quarterback. All right. Yeah, just, you know, just like the type of person Boston Rob wants to go beers with, essentially.
If that's the case, then I'm going to play you something, Donovan. I don't know if you saw this. This was, you know how they get at the draft? And actually, this is one of the things I do like about the draft in the last couple of years. And they really only do this in the NFL. Maybe other leagues will catch on. But they have people get drafted, and then they go sit in another kind of green room where their family members have, like, recorded messages for them. I don't know if you've seen these. And usually they're, like, pretty heartfelt, right? They're like, oh, we're so proud of you. We're so proud of the person you've become. I'm so happy you've achieved your dreams. This was Drake. These are Drake May's brothers who recorded this message. He's the youngest of four brothers. And here are his three older brothers who were asked by the NFL to record a special message for him, which I think will play very well towards the Boston crowd.
Pretty boy. Overrated.
Are you serious?
Apparently, it's a recreation of, like, the Fab Five documentary when those guys were referring to Christian Laettner.
That's right.
Which is really funny, honestly. I gotta say, when I saw that video and I saw Drake May's immediate reaction, I'm the oldest of three. I know you have a brother as well. It did make me laugh. It made me kind of like him a little more. I'm not going to pretend to know anything about his game other than that he is extremely athletic, but it did, from a personality standpoint, give me a little bit more excitement. Maybe more than I did, I would say, after seeing Mac Jones kind of like Million Dollar Man walk to the podium when he was drafted a couple years ago.
It does remind me of when Rob Gronkowski was drafted by the Patriots, and he and his brothers put helmets on and started smashing
right,
each other.
Yes.
There is a brotherly love aspect to it, which I do love. And now, I guess, somehow in the last 17 seconds, you've turned to me, and I'm a Drake May fan. I will say, though, that you could take that exact audio and play it, and that is a direct transcript of what Patriots fans were saying about Mac Jones at the end of last year. So already he fits the part. And that clip will live in infamy if he doesn't play well, because it's exactly what he's going to hear from the South End at Gillette.
All I know is that the team will probably still be bad this year, and he's probably not a lock to start game one. But if recent history has shown us any indication, Donovan, it's that most rookie quarterbacks play at some point. They don't always play in game one, but they play at some point. So I look forward to watching Drake May. Hey, he's number 10 as well. So maybe all the people who bought those number 10 Mac Jones jerseys can just have the nameplate stripped off and just replace it with MAYE and they'll be set. Maybe they don't have to spend hundreds of dollars on a new jersey. Who knows?
Well, he better hope he doesn't play, because the scary wide receiving group of Kendrick Bourne, Demario Douglas, Jalen Polk, Juju Smith-Schuster, KJ Osborne, Tyquan Thornton.
You don't believe in Polk and Bourne? Come on, man.
I don't. But we shall see. Speaking of competition, as there may be one at the QB spot for the first time in earnest in a long time in New England, myself and Cabrel Richards were part of a competition in terms of, we did some light versions of the Canada's Ultimate Challenges recently with some of our Sportsnet brothers and sisters. But more importantly, we watched and consumed the show. If you haven't seen it yet, it's already out on CBC Gem. We go deep on all things Canada's ultimate challenge after the break.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
One massive Canada-wide obstacle course, 20 extraordinary Canadians, 16 mind-blowing challenges. It's season 2 of Canada's Ultimate Challenge every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern. Let's recap the latest episode. Yes, once again, it is the Going Deep podcast, but it is the Canada's Ultimate Challenge edition. Donovan Bennett, obviously. This is Jabril Richards, my favorite guest. And we're going to be breaking down over the next couple weeks one of our shared loves, and that is reality television. Season 2, there are some changes. The teams of 4.
Yeah, that was a nice little twist.
Territories, 4 across the country, where there are different competitions, 16 challenges, going through each region, Atlantic, Eastern, Mountain, Pacific. At the end of each region, the team with the fewest points heads to
an elimination showdown.
And there was some drama too, man.
There was some drama. The team with the most points chooses what other team is in that showdown. The big takeaways for me are the challenges are so difficult.
Yeah.
And the production value on the show so high. What were your biggest takeaways now that we've set the table as to what season 2 entails?
Well, the competitors are all strangers. They're not coming in like pairs of childhood friends or romantic partners. Like, nobody knows each other and they're just thrown on these teams. And early on, Team Red and Team Yellow make an alliance, like, and they're just in survival mode. I'm a survivor, I just won't give up, like, salute to the queen. So that was, like, that planning, that gamesmanship is seen early on. And as you mentioned, it is an arduous, grueling physical challenge for these competitors who I think they just plucked out of CrossFit gyms across the country, because everybody's in phenomenal shape. These are beautiful looking humans doing like the hardest challenges. So those are my big takeaways, like from a macro level on this show.
In episode 1, we're starting out the gate with something incredibly different and difficult. The raise your flag challenge. Essentially, you have to assemble flags based off your spotter's memory. And so there's some different thoughts in terms of who should be going down.
On the zip line, yeah.
Correct. Is it someone who's light, who can get there relatively fast, so we don't have to haul as much? Should it be someone with a great memory?
One thing that jumped out at me is, like, the zip line, they're pulling their teammate down the zip line. So it's not like gravity is shooting them down. It's like pulling. So, like, their hands got to be like shredded beef afterwards. Like, the heat is, like, they didn't do a close-up of their hands, but I'm sure it looked like grilled cheese or some shredded cheese. And then there's, once you get down to the bottom and you're looking at the boat and trying to remember the pattern of these flags, like, think of countries' flags with the patterns in the shapes, then you have to sprint a kilometer up the hill. So you are just gassed. And I don't know, like, when you're running, are you thinking of it? You're trying to remember, okay, blue, green, yellow, blue, green, yellow. But then it's blue, green, yellow. There are squares. There are triangles. There are horizontal lines. There are vertical lines. I don't know how they'd even remember. It's like your wife asking you when you come back from a run, like, how many blue cars did you see today? Like, how are you supposed to remember that? And it was a problem.
Can I give you my MVP of the episode?
Yeah.
My guy, Ninko. And
Ninko was your MVP?
Correct.
What do you mean? You didn't even get to the second event.
Oh, no, we will get there.
Okay.
But he got my MVP out the gate because, one, his testimonial interviews were fire. Guy had me laughing the entire time. Did not lack any confidence.
I'm ready for it.
I mean, yeah?
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
Fearless Ninko steps up. I will do this.
And he was the heaviest person, to your point about pulling up the trek line. But he says, I don't care because I am going to have the best memory. Did he? No. But that did not matter. And then he's like, you know what? I'm actually not going to go all the way back down when I get it wrong. I'm just going to go about halfway and try to use my 20/20 vision because I ate a lot of carrots coming up and I had great eyesight. So I loved his energy. I don't know if his team loved his energy. Well, but in terms of production value, which is how you see I'm viewing the show. I'm not his teammate. I'm just an
You're thinking as a producer.
Viewer. 100% as a producer. Ninko brought it for me. You mentioned it. Challenge 2. The itty-bitty work party.
essentially you're on a canoe, you have to solve a puzzle and then trade at different docks.
Yeah.
And that's when the interpersonal drama started.
Listen, Team Yellow got too cocky for me. They're like, oh, you know, we're just going to take our time with this one. They took their time and they finished last in event number two.
Yeah. I just think that if we take our time, we'll be fine.
I mean, if us taking our time and really understanding it ends up getting us in third, totally. It's better than coming in last.
Yeah.
Right. One thing they didn't show is like, how hard are these puzzles? Because when they're on the boat, they have to figure out these puzzles after they scale the wall and stuff. And like, are they using bed mist to figure out the skill testing question like the rest of us do when we go to, you know, roll up the rim to win? We want to win a free donut or whatever.
Dude, there is zero amount of money you could pay me to go back and do like algebra, long division. Like that is pressure.
Yeah, long division for sure.
Ugh.
And just even like, coming up with equations to solve
calculus. Anyways, I forgot to mention what they were playing for. Other than pride and some future influencer deals, they are getting a VIP trip to the Paris Olympics this summer, obviously on CBC. So a lot of motivation. Anyways, you were saying, bedmas.
Bedmas, yeah, but the pettiness. I love how Team Red and Team Blue, they've already established themselves as rivals, and how we'll see how that plays out over the course of the series. And you mentioned your episode MVP. Adam was my episode MVP.
Okay.
Adam from Newfoundland. He's got a big personality. He's full of confidence. And he was a dude that established the alliance from the get-go.
Yes.
So like a bit of a, he's the one that shows me like great gamesmanship. He also won one of the two competitions in the first episode. So Adam is my episode one MVP.
Okay.
Who do you think is going to win this whole thing?
Great question. I was actually going to take it there because I said earlier that Ninko was my MVP. Shout out to Innisfil, where he reps. Team Green, which he is on, is not my pick to win. In fact, if there was some futures money on who would finish last, bet it all on Green. Put all of the Green
plus
on
10,000 long shot underdog.
I'm not sure about Ninko as a captain, but I am going to be a team player. I am willing to see what he's got.
Yes.
Too many alphas on that team. I would say if I had to put it on one team right now, it'd be Team Blue. Now, having said that, in the blue and red beef probably was, you know, the conflict of this episode, the height of it. In terms of the standings where we are after one episode, you got Red at 8.
Yep.
You got Orange at 8, you got Blue at 6, you got Yellow at 5, and Green, as I mentioned, don't want to put any money on them, they're at 3. And again, these standings matter because if you're wrapping your head around how this season is going to go, each region, you know, those standings after the competitions matter in terms of the team with the best record gets to anoint the team that will face off with the team with the worst record in the showdown. And then the losing team is peace. You're not going to the other regions. You ain't going to see Ottawa. You're not going to make it all the way to BC. You're out. I immediately started thinking, okay, well, how do you game this out? Do you want one of the better teams to be in that showdown?
In that the elimination challenge? Yeah.
Correct.
At the end of the episode?
Or do you just keep it a buck, keep the worst teams in there, hoping that if you come for the king, you best not miss. If you put a good team in there and they come back, well, now you have a target on your back.
Yeah.
So these are like the little plot lines as like a, you know, reality lover that I loved seeing in the formation of this show, and that's where the standings are.
In that alliance, Team Red and Team Yellow agreed not to put their teams in that final elimination challenge moving forward. So that was the one alliance. So Red and Yellow make Orange. Team Orange, that's my futures pick.
Oh,
led by
okay.
The women, Jack and Jenny. Dominic so far is low-key mysterious. And Team Orange wasn't featured that much in this episode. Mm. So I think over the course of the series, we will learn more about the teams and their origin stories and that sort of thing. And Jack made a great point in the second challenge. He said, we should figure out the strategy before racing forward. And I like her thinking. Team dynamics are the most important thing for these for team success, obviously, as well as athletic performance. And everybody's got to play nice in the sandbox, but there are some infighting where they're like, you know, you need to get out of the sandbox and take your ball with you. So I'll enjoy seeing how some of the teams just are starting to fray at the seams and then eventually just fall apart and like Thanos just vanish into the ethos.
We've had a real great time breaking it down. Apparently this is work. We have to watch reality TV, and we got to talk about it. We're going to continue doing it. Let us know what you think of the episode and the series at large. Hit us up online and make sure you're watching. Don't wait to binge. Watch it with us. We are going to be breaking these down throughout the season after every episode. So come hang with us. Enjoy.
Don't miss new episodes of Canada's Ultimate Challenge every Sunday at 8 Eastern. Watch free on CBC Gem.